Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. Kelsey Timmerman wrote the books Where Am I Wearing? Where Am I Eating? And most recently, Where Am I Giving? He's got a lot of interesting things to say about how we interact with the world, which is why Humanities North Dakota invited him to speak as part of their One Book, One North Dakota series. It's an online series of author discussions. And it is supported in part by a grant from the Paris Family Foundation, so thanks to them. And there's more about the whole deal at humanitiesnd.org. Jamie Ridenour is Kelsey Timmerman's interviewer, and we'll start with Jamie quoting a quote that Kelsey quotes.
A quote from Millard Fuller, the founder of Habitat for Humanity: "It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting." And I might be wrong, but that feels almost like a foundational kind of idea for the way you approach these kind of global issues. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think it totally is fair. I think getting out in the world and having experiences ends up changing maybe the way that we think. So I think it's important to. I'm not an expert in the global garment industry. I'm not an expert in the global food economy. I'm not an expert in global and local philanthropy. But if I am an expert in anything, it's going out into the world and meeting people and learning from them and having experiences that then hopefully those experiences change me in some way. Why else go have experiences, you know, then if you're not going to change and learn things?
Tell us how the first books began, because the three books are of a theme, right? You're developing this idea.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't supposed to be a series of books. I thought each book was going to be the last. They would never let me write another book, but they keep letting me write books somehow. So it's called the Where Am I series. And I never imagined that it would happen. I look at them all as kind of one journey, really. So I graduated college with a degree in anthropology, and I saved up money and I went and blew it all traveling. And I grew up in a small rural community. Graduated with 47 students in my high school. Had to drive your tractor to school day, and everyone was kind of the same. And so to go into the world and learn that the people have different points of view and there's different religions and languages. I mean, I knew all that stuff, but to experience that and then to also question, like, I don't necessarily see the world correctly or have the right approach to life. And what can I learn from folks? So I really kind of came from a place of little to no diversity to exploring the world and meeting people and learning from them. And so I was hooked. And at first it was just traveling for traveling's sake. I traveled for 6 months. It was actually during September 11th. I was in Australia, 2001. And I just decided I'm just going to hang out in Australia. And then I went to Thailand and Nepal. And in Nepal, I write about this a little bit, Where Am I Giving? Where has experience where I was on the plane and sitting next to this monk, and you know, you really don't have talked. I make a point of not talking to people at the beginning of a long flight because you just don't know what that can lead to. But towards the end, you know, we start to strike up a conversation. He asked me where I'm going to stay, and I'm like, I don't really have any plans because I never really do. And he's like, come stay with me, and if you're good, you can stay longer, and if not, whatever. So he ended up being like the head of this lamasery. And I spent, where they teach like young kids to be monks, and there's monks that are like off in some room and they haven't talked to anybody for years and meditating at 4 or 5 in the morning. And I would wake up and there'd be this chanting coming up the hillsides, and I just like, I can't believe I'm here. Like, I really wanted to start writing about these experiences. It was never the intention of like, I'm going to go have these experiences and someday I'll write a book. But I wanted to be this conduit and share with people back in my hometown and people other places that may not have those experiences to show them kind of what those experiences were like. And so that led to, I got back and I just was curious about the world and wanted to go somewhere else. And I had this t-shirt that said, "Come with me, my tropical paradise." And I thought, I'm fascinated with the world. I know I could go anywhere that would be different from here. So I'll go wherever this t-shirt was made. and it was made in Honduras. So I decided I would show up. Maybe I should go to the factory. Maybe I can meet the person who made this shirt. And so I had adventures in Honduras. And then I showed up at the factory. And at first, my travels were very much Kelsey out in the world having adventures. And then I met the guy who made my shirt and who was my same age. We were both, I think, 26, 25 at the time. And that's kind of when it all got real. It got heavier to realize, to look at myself through his eyes and to wrestle with the inequality that exists in the world, the lack of opportunities that some folks have and the abundance of opportunities, and I put myself in that category that I had. Here I was traveling willy-nilly around the world, researching where going to Honduras because my shirt was made there, and here he was working the shirt, the factory that made my shirt. And so that's when it got heavy, became this bigger, larger kind of investigation, and I went to other places my clothes were made to meet the people who made my clothes, and that became my first book.
And so how much do you feel like your lack of, not lack of, but like purpose?
Well, lack of, you're right.
Well, I wasn't going to say, but just your, like, I'm not going to have a preconceived notion of what I'm going to be doing. I don't have to have an agenda. I don't have to have a schedule. I mean, how much of that feeds into how much of that is necessary?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be impossible to not travel somewhere without some preconceived notions. And I always appreciate when those are challenged in some way. Or so often we think a thing is true, and then we go meet someone who's actually, like, that is their reality, and we see it's much more complex than we originally thought it was. So I've always had preconceived notions. I try to keep an open mind, but I definitely have an open plan typically, especially when I first started doing this kind of work. And I still do now for the most part. And I think it's a strength and it's a weakness. Sometimes for Where Am I Giving, I showed up in India because I had a friend who knew Gandhi's great-grandson. And so I had a meeting with Gandhi's great-grandson. Well, you know. Like, I didn't know if that was going to be a half-hour meeting, 45-minute meeting. Like, it's a long way to go just for a 45-minute meeting. And so I showed up at the airport, and that I got there late, so I got an airport hotel just to get my bearings. And then I'm in that hotel looking out at Mumbai, like, oh, my gosh, this is a city of who knows how many, probably tens of millions of people practically. And I don't know a single person, like, what's going to happen. And then I ended up meeting some really amazing people. One of my favorite stories from Where Am I Giving is a young man named Ashok, who started a soccer program and getting kids in school and stuff. And I had no idea. I think it's a strength, but it's also a weakness. And it's almost always a little uncomfortable for me still, even though I know just kind of let the winds blow me where they may. At times, it's still kind of uncomfortable.
I'm looking at another giving rule from the book. This one is giving locally connects you to people. Giving globally connects you to causes. So I want to talk about or I'd like to hear you talk about sort of the balance between those things. We're particularly in a time where there's a lot of causes people are talking about and thinking about. And I think one of the things that stymies a lot of people who have good intentions, I know I felt this, is, I don't know where to start. I feel helpless in the face of the size of the causes that I want to be a part of. Can you talk a little bit about how the idea of localized giving feeds into that?
Yeah, I feel like we have dual existences. I mean, we know about all of the world now, and we're global citizens and we're local citizens. So this is something I've struggled with quite a lot when I graduated college. I was out in the world traveling. I was a citizen of everywhere and nowhere. I was a global citizen, but I didn't know people on the ground doing things. I just was out in the world. And so as I started to travel around, I saw the people that made the biggest impact were the Kenyans helping Kenyans, Cambodians helping Cambodians, and And so then I started, when I got back from my very first, what became the Where Am I Wearing trip, and I came back to Muncie, where I live now, and settled down and planted roots in 2007. I started to volunteer a ton, and then I started to be more of a local citizen. So I feel like we need to embrace both of these roles, and to ignore our local is not right, and to ignore our global citizenship is not right. So I think we need to kind of marry the two. And in terms of local, so like I will give to causes just because I know someone who's associated with it, and I know it's important to them, and I want to support their giving. With global, I try to be much more intentional. Now, with giving globally, giving funds globally, you can sometimes magnify your impact by 100 as a local donation. So I'm not saying ignore all local giving, but you're really missing out if you don't give financial donations globally in terms of the impact of your investment. And I think that's a good way to look at it. But the truth is, Americans give about less than 6% of our income goes to global causes. So I think we all should kind of take it to the next level in terms of our global giving. And there's a great organization called GiveWell.org that has some great, super effective nonprofits. And they're part of this movement called the Effective Altruism Movement, which I find really fascinating. Now, the effective altruism movement would say that you really shouldn't give locally because your dollars can go so much further in a place like Kenya. So we all need to kind of wrestle with this. I give both locally and globally. And in terms of volunteering is something you can do where you are a local. And we should do that. And only 25% of us actually volunteer. And so give to those organizations you volunteer with. And if you volunteer 100 hours a year or more, some studies have shown that those individuals are happier. So it's good for you as well. So I know that's just kind of a muddy answer, but yeah. And especially now during this time of so much need and so much societal upheaval and questions, and especially all in an election year, what I've seen is a shift to, it's hard to see beyond our own borders. The closer to home the problems, the harder it is to see beyond those problems. And what's, you know, especially with the pandemic, the job loss, the health consequences. We almost always hear that in terms of our own country. But think you live in a slum in Kenya. You live in an informal settlement in Kenya, and a global pandemic hits. You had trouble getting a job before when you lived with your situation. You're trying to get a job outside of the slum community. And now that's even harder. You're living in very close quarters. So a lot of the people that I write about and Where Am I Giving are on the front lines of just trying to provide food for folks now and just trying to help their neighbors. And so when we only focus on one, right now I feel like we have real problems in our country. And it's important that we focus on them. But also there's real hurt and there's real opportunity around the world to make a difference as well. So if we just ignore our global responsibilities as well, I don't think that's good.
You are listening to a recording, an edited recording of a webinar that was done as part of Humanities Indy's One Book, One North Dakota series. The author is Kelsey Timmerman. Jamie Ridenour is interviewing him, and Jamie passes along a question that came in from one of the webinar attendees.
Pat asks, mentions from the book, The Appreciation of Ice Cream, demonstrating the concept of enjoying the small things of life. And was curious whether you have stayed in touch with some of the people in the book, like Ashok is who they mentioned. But
yeah. So the ice cream, Myanmar is the most generous country on the planet. So I went to go experience their culture. Now that said, it's like we've been talking, it's not easy. There's also like the longest ongoing civil war and an act of genocide happening in Myanmar at the same time. Yet the most generous country on the planet. And a lot of that has to do with almsgiving and the, I think it's Theravada Buddhism, like the culture of giving there. And so I want to kind of experience some of that culture. And one of the things that people would do when they go to Myanmar is they'll go on meditation retreats for 10 days. Well, unfortunately, I didn't have 10 days, so I talked them down to like a day. I think it was 6 hours. So it's very, very American of me. Yes, like, do you have anything like a drive-through meditation? But still, 6 hours, woof, that was something. And so you had to be very mindful of everything that you did. Like, it was a 1 hour of walking meditation where you thought of your right foot and your left foot. You thought of every single movement that it took to make those steps. And then 1 hour of sitting and breathing and just thinking about your breath. And then at some certain point, we were able to go to lunch. And so, but you were still supposed to stay in this headspace of like concentrate on every single movement. And so I was really at – when I first showed up, I saw these people walking really slow. I'm like, what's wrong with these people? You know, and then I was one of them because it you just realize like right now I'm all like, wah! But there, when you think about every single movement and when you actually taste ice cream and there's ice cream there and you feel how it feels and you think about how it feels in your mouth where most of the time – right now, the NBA is playing, and I'm watching NBA, and I'll get a bowl of ice cream. Oh, where'd all my ice cream go? It's all gone. So that's kind of the story there, and I appreciate Pat's comment about that. And in terms of the people, I do keep in touch with some. So I keep in touch with Ashok some through WhatsApp. He's a pretty busy guy, and he's only gotten busier since I met him. He's doing some really cool things. I know that during the pandemic – he's been really active to helping his community.
But these are relationships that you've built, these kind of connections. They are, so you do still like are aware of what he's doing, and you guys do talk occasionally, but just you're building real connections.
Yeah, I try to keep in touch with folks, and it's easier now than it was in the beginning. And when I first started doing this work, there wasn't social media. So, you know, how much that counts is keeping in touch with folks. But, you know, I will have back and forth with some of the folks I've met. And it's like you start to lose some touch with the folks through the years. But I've had an opportunity to go back to some countries that I visited and wrote about and meet people who I wrote about. And that's been pretty special to whether it's give them a copy of the book or to talk with them. And like, they thought that I probably forgot them. I thought they probably forgot me, but it turns out we all remembered each other. And so it is, and to interact in a way that's just not me like writing a story about them. So often I won't write updates about meeting like the garment workers I met in Cambodia, two young women. And I had a chance to meet up with them again. And so that's always pretty special to do that. But I definitely have, I'd say some guilt, of it's impossible to keep tabs with everyone. And I'm just not always the best at keeping tabs with my friends here in my own community, you know? So I do some, but I wouldn't say like I'm like, you know, and some people I connect with more than others and we stay in better touch.
So let me switch gears a little bit and ask you a little bit about the Facing Project. Tell us a little bit about that. And in particular, I'm interested in how it intersects. We're going to see it pretty easily, but how it intersects with the work in the books.
Yeah, so the Facing Project is a nonprofit community storytelling project that creates understanding and empathy through stories that inspire action. If that sounds like a mission statement, it is a mission statement. We, you know, we worked hard on it, and we kind of it just comes out on autopilot now. So, so I was kind of going back to that period of time where I traveled and I saw local people making a difference, and I came back and I really got engaged in volunteering. And sometimes I would question the impact I was actually having with my work as a volunteer. And so I started to think, well, what am I good at? What could I bring that maybe other people couldn't bring? And so I was volunteering with this organization called Teamwork for Quality Living. And they work with individuals who are in poverty. And you kind of get matched in a small group with them, and you're just there they kind of, they're the captains, and they kind of steer their group of what their goals are, and you can help out in some way if you can. It's usually not a financial help of any type. So I had been engaged with this organization for a couple of years, and there was a debate in the local newspaper about how many people live in poverty. This was right around 2010 when the previous census happened. And the results came out, and it was something like in our community, well, if you count Ball State students, which is our local university, only 25% of people are in poverty, as opposed to 35%, which is what the student is what the was. If you take out the Ball State students, it's only 25%, and it kind of bugged me because I'm like, how many people actually know someone? And I know that a lot of the circles that I run in, maybe people that they don't know they know someone who's living in poverty, and I through this organization knew a lot of folks, and I thought the most important statistic is one. Do you know one single person who lives in poverty? Do you know one single person who is an immigrant? Do you know one single person who is a member of the LGBTQ community? And until you do you know how to what the person needs, or how to help that person, or to help to find solutions with problems that they might face? And so often we have such strong opinions about a topic that impacts people, and we may not have even met a single person who's impacted by a topic. So I came up with this idea of, well, what if we had writers in the community? I have been, I feel like, transformed, influenced, inspired by carrying other people's stories around, and it being part of sharing that story. What if we could get other local writers in that role, and we'd match them up with people in the organization? And that became the first facing project, where we had, I think, like 18 stories, in a kind of monologue from the individual's point of view about the realities of their life. And one of the volunteers of that project was a close friend of mine now, J.R. Jameson. And so he's in the higher ed service learning world, and he was part of the project and thought it was kind of cool, and thought, hey, what if we kind of try to get other communities to do that? I'm like, I don't exactly know what that looks like. So it started from there, and now we've done over 100 projects. We've had thousands of people participate as writers and storytellers. We publish books. We just had a book now come out from the Dayton community. It was the year anniversary of the shooting that happened in Dayton in the Oregon District. The mayor was heavily involved with that, and Dayton citizens really kind of rallied around the project. And we have a show on NPR, where our local Indiana public radio station, that we share some of the stories and talk about them. And it, you know, we see that it's connections where people kind of come together and they collaborate. You know, you listen to someone else's story, and then you reflect that story back to them, and then you collaborate on what the story is that's actually shared in writing or performed on stage. And so that connection is part of what we like to see. But it's also educating people about the realities that folks are facing. And we hope that leads to some type of action, where we had a project in Atlanta. They did sex trafficking, and they took some of the stories and they put them at a kiosk in the Atlanta airport, which is apparently a major hub for human trafficking. And it would educate – people could listen to the story on headphones, and then they would be educated how to kind of spot someone who's being trafficked. And so, like, that's a really cool example of how these stories can be used to get people to act and to educate them.
That's really great. And it's a great way to I was really struck the beginning of you this talk today when you were talking about how this began for you, just the realization that you were in a space where everybody looked the same. Everybody, you know, you're in a pretty homogenous social bubble. And you know, travel is one way to break that, but it's as you acknowledge, it's sort of a privilege to be able to do that. Not everybody can travel the world.
Matt, I think that our privileges come with responsibilities, and so once we are aware of, and it's kind of where am I wearing and where am I eating kind of flow into where am I giving, and that where am I wearing and where am I eating? I'm kind of looking at the injustices and inequalities that exist in the world, and where am I giving? And it's like, okay, now that I know this stuff, what do we do? What do I do? What do we do? And awareness without action leads to guilt. I feel like the more you become aware of the different issues in our world that, and you want to do something about that too. You need to find that thing. And for me, the Facing Project is a big part of that. That's what's been really weird about the pandemic though too. And I've had the Facing Project to work on, but when it's to help, it's you stay home and don't be around anybody, you know. And you're like, no, there's a big problem. I'm like, look, what can we do?
Well, and that's one of the things I love about this book is giving us that kind of what do you do about it once you're aware of this stuff, other than just walk around, which a lot of us do. Now I know this thing, so I'm just going to walk around feeling horrible about the world and about my place in it. We had a guy come in to do, when I worked at the University of Mary in Bismarck, we had a guy from the National Labor Council come in to do talks to the students and about, labor abuses in the garment industry. And one of the things he said was, it doesn't make any, the idea of boycotting, like I'm not going to buy from Walmart or whatever, that's fine if it makes you feel better, but it's not, it's not possible to buy a piece of clothing really in the United States that doesn't feed off of this industry. So I remember a lot of students saying, well, then what's the use? What do you do if it's that pervasive?
Yeah. And I mean, that specific example, so I wrote about the garment industry, and I think my book came out in 2008, the first edition of it. And then you like to try to end a book with some hope, not just like tell people about all the issues that these individuals are facing and then just leave them hanging. There's nothing you can do about it, right? and then in 2008, it was hard. It was hard to kind of point to places that were doing it right. We're having these conversations, but now there's a lot more. So as individual shoppers, there are things that we can do. There are companies now that are focusing on the how much their employees are paid, and there's fair trade clothing is now a thing. Patagonia is working on regenerative organic certification that is working with organic cotton. And also the certification has fair trade standard. You have to meet the fair trade standard as well. How did we get there? We got there because of the work I forget what organization said he was from, National Labor Council. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones, the Workers' Rights Consortium and groups like that, the work that they do and have done, and how they've mobilized members to speak up and speak out. And that factory collapse happened in Bangladesh, and like over 1,000 people were killed. And most of us probably have forgotten that even happened, which is probably the truth, because it happened 2013, I think. But there was people engaged in that topic and in that issue that really ended up being a tipping point where it launched this ability for a consumer now to go out and buy more ethical clothing. So the people did the work and got involved on a person-to-person level, and that led to change.
And as Americans, we're so trained to want instant gratification. I think, sometimes people can find it disheartening that the change is, when you say change, you mean years of work, but it means that the work is happening, right? Even if you don't see it, the small drops of water making the tidal wave.
And if you can't, if it's important to you and you can't like get engaged on the ground level, like how can you support that work? Because we can't all support every cause.
Sue is asking, and we're kind of dancing around this question anyway, so let's go ahead and do it. Sue is asking how you would sum up your call to action from this book.
I think the call to action for the first two is that is called to a kind of awareness. And in that awareness, there were some things that you could do. But I feel like Where Am I Giving is a much more of a call to action to give. And I guess I'll share a story to kind of capture what this means, kind of I think the big summation of the book is. So I went to go meet Gandhi's great grandson, Tushar, and I had this idea that this book would be, I would find the giving equation. That's what everybody wants. Just tell me how much I need to give, Kelsey. Like, is this a good organization? Tell me exactly what percentage of my income should I give to what type of organizations, locally and globally, how much I should volunteer. And then I can just like, do that. Hey, I'm doing my part. And that's what I wanted. That's what I set out on this book to find. And then so I show up at Tushar's like apartment. He's meeting with some like Save Tibet movement. So other people were there to kind of see this wise person. And then I tell him about the good person equation. He's like basically telling me that's stupid. He said it nicer than that. Like, that's dumb. He's like, you need to give more. You just need to progress in your giving. And so there is no good person equation. But what is the best that we can do with the gifts that we have been given to make a difference? And what I found is that it's a very rewarding way to look at the world then too. There's a great book I recommend. It's called The Gift. It's written by Lewis Hyde. And it's kind of, I read that book, and all of a sudden, between that, reading that book and meeting Tushar, like, my vision of giving like expanded quite a lot. And in the book, The Gift, it talks about a gift is only a gift if it never stops. Gifts connect us to one another. They're not commodities. And so I started to see this connecting that happens through giving, and also the meaning and purpose. Even getting back to the garments, most people come in contact with that world and the world of sweatshops, and they just feel helpless. But then once you realize there are other ways that you can spend your dollars and support a good cause, then that kind of brings this joy to your life that you didn't have before. When you realize that there's a chocolate bar made by a company that's really helping pay a wage to folks and to farmers who can send their kids to school and kind of improve their lives, then you get to enjoy chocolate and you get to connect, and it's just more purpose in your life when you start to look through this lens of giving. And so I feel like that's been a big thing for me is when you look at your life as there is no good person equation. There you just need to give more. And also we have to be aware. And like the goal of the first two books. And when you are more aware in your move to act, and you do act, it brings more happiness and more purpose to your life. There's half the world's population lives on less than $2.50 per day. If you earn $52,000 a year more, and you're in like the top 90% of global earners. And I think those things come with responsibility, and we need to act out of a way that's not out of guilt, but out of a place of connection.
How do you balance not falling into the sort of savior trap?
We're not Batman. We're not even Robin. Like I write in the book that we're the Alfreds. Alfred helps supply Batman with tools and resources and knowledge, and then Batman just goes out and does it. And so I feel like that's a really great way to look at this. Now, it's not always easy. I mean, none of this is none of this is easy always to figure out. There's an organization called Give Directly that they give money directly to individuals who are living in poverty, and they can do whatever they want with that money. And this actually got some play in the debates, the presidential debates, where Andrew Yang was talking about universal basic income. Well, Give Directly does that. And so it's just really removing ourselves from how are you going to let me tell you what to do. I'm going to show up and I'm going to tell you what to do. Like, what if someone from Kenya showed up right now and said, hey, here's what you need to do. I know what's going on. Like, it's absurd. All you need to do is reverse that situation. So if you're volunteering or you're giving in a situation, if you just like reverse the roles, how does that look to you? Does it seem absurd? Where all of a sudden, you know, we go to Uganda and, we had first aid training, so now we're basically playing nurse. You know, like I can do like, and that happens all the time. If you're not allowed to serve in this capacity in your own community, don't go do it somewhere else. If you're not a medical professional in your own community, don't become a medical professional in Uganda.
So a couple of questions on the side. In the section of the book about the teamwork circles, you say it was challenging to have conversations with people in poverty that didn't begin with what do you do, because of class division, causing class division. What conversation starters did you come up with?
Yeah, that's a really good one. I'll have to think back. You know, we're so enculturated to like the very first thing, you know, sitting next to somebody on the plane or at a restaurant or situation where some small talk is required. Like, oh, what do you do? So sometimes I would say, what did you get up to today? Or, what interest do you have? Or what hobbies? Kind of more of those generic conversations that didn't center around what our job is or was. And it always starts there. And how, like, that's not a great place to start a conversation that we're much more than our jobs. Still, that's the question that people ask so often. And I'm sure that I probably even done it recently in the circles capacity. You knew that you knew not to start the conversation there. But I don't think we should ever really start the conversation there. But like 85% of the time it does. Yeah. And for me, like, people are like, oh, what are you? And like, I get pulled into it. It's like, oh, I'm a writer. And they're like, oh, glaze over. You know what I mean? Like, you live in your parents' basement, don't you? You know? It's like, so it's always kind of, they're either not interested or they're too interested.
If you were to write a novel relating to one particular individual you engaged with in the book, who would you choose?
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. Who would be on the? You know, there's the Marine Jake Harriman, who's like, he's already from like a action adventure novel, and the stuff that's happened to him is so fascinating. And the work he's doing, I think, is really good. It's very, very community focused too. Like, he's, you know, it's the organization is called Nuru International. So he would be probably up there. But someone I keep in close touch with is Rosie, who is in Kenya. She's lives in Korogocho, the community I visited that was the most violent, dangerous, informal settlement slum. They call it, I always feel weird calling it slums because I know people who live there, but that's what they call it too. So she lives there and she's just absolutely remarkable. And what she's lived already is like a novel with, tragedy in so many different ways, like her life. So I find her really fascinating. I just love her. Like, my mom has got to know her now through Facebook too. And so it was, we've been, and I never imagined that the good person equation would lead me to this, but like it's really easy to send money directly to people in Kenya. So I do that with Rosie, and I have family and friends who helped put Rosie through school. And it was hundreds of dollars. It wasn't like, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And since the pandemic hit, one day, I sent Rosie some money just because I was thinking about her and to help her support her work in the community. And then my mom did the exact same thing the exact same day. And so she and then, you know, Ashok too, just amazing. There he lives in his, at least when I met him, he was still living in his community. I haven't asked now because I don't want to make him feel bad if he's moved outside of his community and is still doing that work. But his story about being the lowest caste of in India, and now is like on TV shows and has celebrities from all over the world coming over to visit with him and his organization. So, I mean, all these people, remarkable people. And Tim Hardy, who's in Myanmar, who showed up at the U.S. consulate to translate for some monks right before the big uprising in Myanmar. And someone was like, hey, do you want to go to the United States? And he's like, sure. And so he basically had he had what he was wearing. His mom met him at the airport, gave him a couple things, and there he was off for years in the United States before coming back. And so just if you just ask the next person that you see, who's the most giving person that you can think of, who's the most inspiring person you can think of, and then you go meet that person, and then you ask that person the same question, like you're going to come across some pretty remarkable stories. So it would be really hard to some of them just, I feel like, write themselves. But yeah, there's lots of good stories.
You're listening to Kelsey Timmerman. He is talking about his books, Where Am I Wearing? Where Am I Eating? And actually mostly about his recent book, Where Am I Giving? He's talking with Jamie Ridenour as part of Humanities Indies One Book, One North Dakota webinar series. This is an edited recording of the webinar. There are more to come in this series. You can find out more at humanitiesnd.org.
Yeah, the impact, you were talking about how far the impact goes. Before we started, I was talking to Kelsey about my friend David Lamont, who does peace work, and he does a lot of work in Guatemala, and his realization of that was he was in Guatemala. He's a singer-songwriter and was down there, on vacation, and toured a school, and they were telling him that, you know, they didn't have plumbing in the school, and they need a lot of supplies to upgrade. It was just falling apart, and they said, we just don't have the money to do it. And he finally asked him how much money they needed, and it was the equivalent of about $1,000. And, you know, he went back to the States and did like 3 concerts and asked at each place for people to give money, and completely renovated their school by, you know, 5 people that gave money. And it was the amount of, like you say, the power of the impact that it doesn't seem like much to us.
Yeah. Yet only 6% of our giving goes to international causes like that. I was in Zambia and I was visiting a community there, and they said their kids can't go to school because they can't afford it. And I'm like, well, how much is it? And they're like, $6 for the year. And it's like, oof, like that, you know, that.
A couple more questions. George says, there are a few companies out there that seem to be really conscientious about how they operate, like Patagonia. But for other companies, how can we trust that they're being responsible? As a consumer and as a person who's able to give, is doing research part of the responsibility that I have?
I don't think it's possible for us to be 100% ethical consumers. I mean, first off, we're probably burning some, we have the lights on right now, burning some, you know, gas, releasing greenhouse gases. So, but just incorporating things like wearing one thing a day, eating one thing a day, at least that you know where it comes from, and educating yourself and looking for, like, where could I, get a shirt, or where could I get some shoes that were made in a different way? And over time, it just like happens to build up, and all you eat is the fair trade chocolate because it's better chocolate, you know. Now, all you wear are these shoes that you found or from this company that's doing it right, and it's not a subtraction from your life. It's an addition to it, like it. And I think that's in giving in general. First off, like consuming isn't giving. I think that's important, but I do think we have roles as ethical consumers. But I found that it's added connection and a purpose to my life when I've shopped with my ethics in some way. But there is like some thought, and some studies have shown that people who shop fair trade feel like, oh, I've met my good quota, and they're less likely to do follow it up with a good act. They're less likely to give later. So like don't do that. That's not a good trend.
From Lyle, how do you feel personally about the direct aid approach?
Yeah, I mean the person to person. You know, there's a very few times that I do that, but I mean, I have an ongoing, you know, like I said, I support Rosie. And so often when it comes to giving, we're so worried about, well, could these funds be misappropriated? We're more concerned than that than we're concerned with, like, the loss of potential in another human being. Or so we have to let some of that go. In terms of when I give to Rosie, I mean, I hope Rosie goes. Like, my mom gave that day, and it was her birthday. That's what we gave. My mom gave, and then Rosie sent a picture that she bought her first birthday cake. And, like, she gives so much for community. I hope she spends some of that on herself. Now, in terms of percentage, I mean, I'm not even sure. So I kind of come with a good person equation is, like, you should throw it out. But at the end, I kind of come up with, well, here's what I kind of recommend. 2% local, 2% global, 1% to, you know, organizations and individuals that maybe aren't meeting that immediate need of hunger, fighting poverty, things like that. So arts, humanities, which maybe this is the best place to have that only be 1% in this conversation. But I went to Facing Project. So, like, we're basically like an arts and humanities kind of program. So we're in that same boat. But I would look at giving to Rosie as just part of my 2% of global giving.
Do you see one of your giving rules is that there are fads to giving, like fashion, you know, comes and goes. Do you see social media, like Facebook fundraisers, for instance, playing a bigger part in the ways we give?
A lot of nonprofits are using those types of fundraisers as well. Now, if you're talking about more of like an individual, like GoFundMe campaign or money that goes directly to an individual, I think that's really, I don't think Facebook has anything quite like that. But I mean, a lot of nonprofits use Facebook to solicit donations and share their cause and allow people to support their cause. We have a software through the Facing Project, and it's expensive for some of these programs to be able to have like a social kind of sharing around giving and support and creating their own cause. And Facebook makes that pretty. Makes that pretty easy to do. So I definitely, I mean, I'm sure that 10 years from now, maybe that type of giving isn't happening, but I think it works well now. But if you're talking more about like the how to help an individual person, and you come across someone's story on a GoFundMe and you decide to give, you know, that's, I mean, a lot of that is just kind of filling in the cracks of our society where there's not the social safety net or support or jobs that allow people to support themselves in that way. And I would love to see that type of need for giving for that to go away. But I don't think it's going to.
See, I mean, the Facebook fundraisers, I've seen a real uptick in the past year, year and a half of people sharing their individual, like, you know, it's your birthday on Facebook, so you say, for my birthday, could you please give to this? And it is an easy thing, like you put the link over and it's a smooth way for that to happen. And it's made me aware of causes that I wouldn't have stumbled across before because they are the pet interest of a mutual friend of mine or something.
I mean, I think it's one of the problems with giving is that somehow in society I think there's a passage in the Bible that talks about this, like you're not supposed to share where you give. So people on social media, you don't say how much you give or what kind of organizations you give to. Don't do that. But guess what? I just got a brand new car and here's my new brand new design kitchen. Like, why is it that we can't talk about our giving in this same way? Like, I would love if our social status was based on not what car you drove, but what organizations and how much you supported. So there needs to be this shift. And it can inform us about other organizations, but what I worry about is through the process of where am I giving, I realize that intentionality is really important in all of this. It shouldn't be it shouldn't be just like a knee-jerk reaction. Like, I was talking to a group of people, and they're like, well, what, when I get this thing in the mail, should I give to them? Well, it's about this cause. It seems important. I was like, just never give to anything that shows up in the mail. You know, if you get it and then you and like go to their website and look into it, and it's something that's important to you, and then you make that decision to support that organization, do that. But just this knee-jerk reaction giving, or the PetSmart, it still hits me every time, of like, going there to buy dog food for Jersey, the pit bull, you know, and they're like, would you like to donate $1 to, you know, orphaned puppies or whatever? And I'm like, no. And I feel like this is like jerk. But like, to me, that's not intentional giving. Unless that is some, like, what organization does that even go to? Like, often you don't even know. They don't even tell you. And it's probably going to a good cause. But we should be more intentional about our giving than just like, oh, this opportunity to give? Okay.
It seems, Pat asks, it seems as though your perception of religious organization involvement in these communities changed. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I'll just kind of share it from kind of how I feel like it evolved. So I had some not great, sometimes I would be traveling places where it would just be missionaries and mercenaries or people doing business, and then it would be me. And no one could quite figure out what I was doing there if I wasn't associated with one of these groups. And that you're not spreading the gospel, you're not selling LED lights to poor people, you're not, you know, here in the military, then what are you doing here? Surely you're with one of those groups. So I had some not great interactions with religious organizations before. It was one specifically in Honduras where I met this guy, and he was sharing about his experiences, and it was just really, really rubbed me the wrong way. He was in it for himself. He was ran a program that taught young girls, young women, and he was taking one of those young women back to marry, and he had to choose between which one. He's kind of like bragging about which woman am I going to choose to take back to Florida to be my wife. And ever since then, and I know you shouldn't base everything off of one experience, but I've also been leery of this idea, and there's a quote that kind of sums it up, like, to the hungry, food is God. Like this idea of my God is providing me with food, and if you come and learn about my God, then here's some food. So I still struggle with that. I struggle with the loss of culture in terms of missionaries going into places and saying, get rid of your religion, dress this way, follow these rules. And that's something I touch a little bit on the book. That's more of a personal thing that I guess I'm sharing here. And then so I went with a Christian NGO, because I had some friends that were part of it, to Kenya. We went to this community called the Mathari Valley. And they paired up with churches. And they were very much listening to what they needed. And it wasn't the white people showing up, the Americans showing up to say, here's what you need to do. It was like, what do you need and how can we help? And when they showed up, they automatically had this connection. And it wasn't like they were evangelizing. The people were that they'd already made that journey themselves. So they showed up, they shared this immediate connection, and they could get to work. And so that really changed my mind. And not like, you know, holy. I mean, there's just as there's secular nonprofits and NGOs that are bad and good, there's the same for like, you know, religious organizations too. So I guess that would be kind of my evolution, where I'm not just going to dismiss them because of they're a faith-based organization.
I'm sure each city you travel to is very meaningful and impactful. Is there one that has had a very profound impact on you, or more meaningful, the most meaningful?
I feel like one of the big experiences I had, and I've written about this in all three of the books I've written about this, and it was I went to Cambodia because my blue jeans were made there, and I showed up at a factory to where they were made, and eventually in that experience, that month I was in Cambodia, someone that said I should go to the city dump to, you know, if you really want to know what life is like for some people, go to the dump. If you want to understand the garment industry, go to the city dump. And I showed up, and it was the worst place I've ever been in my life. It was like burning trash, spilled forth this acrid smoke, and it, like, the smell made me want to throw up, and it, the smoke burned your eyes, and just like super unhealthy place. And there were kids that were working in there. There was adults and kids, and just such a, I mean, every person that's worked, I've got to know some of the folks who've been there and talked to them now. And they can't talk about that experience without like breaking into tears of what they saw and what they found, and people that they found that were dead, and children that they found that were dead in this dump. And I saw, the experience was, I saw an 11-year-old girl, whose name was Ratana, and she, I saw her, and I didn't know what to do. She was with some other kids, and I just pulled out my Frisbee, started playing Frisbee, because nothing made sense, so why not play Frisbee? And so then we got done playing Frisbee, and she went back to work, and I wanted to help her, and I didn't, because I'm just one person, and there's so many people like her, so much need in the world, like, what can I possibly do? But looking at her made me think, well, would she be better off working in a garment factory at 11? Like, we say that, oh, we don't want kids making our clothes, but here's a kid working in this dump. So, and I'm not a proponent of, like, we should have more kids working in garment factories, and let's get more kid jobs. And but that really was influential in that I saw that the world wasn't cut and dry, black and white, you know, good, bad, right, wrong. And that there's this gray area and these realities that people face. And when we try to look at the world from their point of view, it's much different than from ours. And so I actually, in Where Am I Giving, one of the places I went was back to Cambodia. And but that experience was, and I walked around that dump again and got to meet Ratana. We found her. And so I think that really led to this, looking at the world with its complexity, and that's not comfortable, you know. We shouldn't feel comfortable living in a world with such inequality and injustice. And that's how it should be. We should be always uncomfortable. And I'm comfortable now with that knowledge that I will always be uncomfortable, that there isn't a good person equation to just, like, do these things, and, like, you're off the hook, and you can let that weight off of your shoulder. Like, this, the awareness, these people's stories and experiences, there should be a weight to that you don't let go of, that you do carry.
Kelsey Timmerman speaking there, wrapping up with discomfort. He was talking about his book, Where Am I Giving, which followed two previous books, Where Am I Wearing and Where Am I Eating. He was interviewed by Jamie Ridenour, and it was part of Humanities Indy's One Book, One North Dakota series. And here would be a good place to mention that it is sponsored in part by a donation from the Paris Family Foundation. You can go to humanitiesindy.org and see a number of online events that they offer for free, and sign up for them or look at ones that have been done in the past. For this particular edited version of the webinar, you can go to praypublic.org and see it, along with all other kinds of interesting material that you can download, listen to online, sign up for the podcast, or even actually listen to on the radio. Stay tuned for some good music coming up here on Prairie Public. I'm Bill Thomas.